Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the suicidal internet entrepreneur and advocate for the electronic commons, Aaron Swartz, who appears to have been hounded to his death by overzealous government prosecutors, unable to distinguish between malicious hackers and defenders of free speech and freedom of information. His friend and mentor, the director of the Center for Ethics at Harvard and professor of law and leadership at Harvard Law School, Lawrence Lessig, joins us to discuss the tragic loss of this young progressive activist. Then we'll examine the intervention in Mali by French forces to prevent a takeover of the country by Islamist rebels from the north who are alleged to be members of AQIM, Al-Qaeda, in the Maghreb. The former United States Ambassador to Nigeria, John Campbell, joins us to discuss the likely short-term outcome and the longer-term possibility of a protracted guerrilla war in a failed state where World Heritage Sites have already been desecrated by rebels who were cutting off hands in the name of Islam. Then finally, we will look into the state of working America, where wages as a share of America's gross domestic product fell last year to a record low of 43.5%, down from 49% in 2001. Economist, author, and analyst Lawrence Michel, the president of the Economic Policy Institute, joins us to discuss how wages are falling while profits are rising, and how much stagnant wages are contributing to the growing income inequality in America. Let's now turn to the recent death of an internet freedom fighter. And joining us now is Lawrence Lessig, the director of the Edmund J. Safra Foundation Center for Ethics at Harvard University and a professor of law and leadership at Harvard Law School. Previously, he was a professor of law at Stanford Law School and the University of California Law School. And additionally, Lawrence Lessig clerked for Judge Richard Posner on the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals and Justice Antonin Scalia on the United States Supreme Court. His latest book is Republic Lost, How Money Corrupts Congress and a Plan to Stop It. Welcome to Background Briefing, Lawrence Lessig.
I'm glad to be here. I'm sorry to be here under these circumstances.
And it obviously is really deeply sad for you since you were a close friend and for a while Aaron Swartz's lawyer. I had spoken to him a number of times when he was the co-founder of the Progressive Change Campaign Committee. And this is somebody from my brief. Obviously, he served as a research fellow at your center at Harvard University, the Safra Center for Ethics. But my sense of him was this was a guy that was putting a lot of what he'd earned through his innovation and talent back into political activism. This was somebody that seemed to be, for a young person, deeply engaged in social responsibility and civic activity.
Yeah, everything he did from a kid on was focused on trying to do something for the public interest that he believed should be pushed. You know, and originally, that was about making the internet function better. So the RSS standard, which syndicates information on the web, was an example of that. And then he developed the technical infrastructure for Creative Commons. That was about licensing material freely. He worked at the archive.org to build the Open Library Project. These were all ways in which he was trying to use his technical skills to advance something he believed was in the public interest. And at the end of his extremely short life, he then turned the skills he had learned towards really progressive politics. And that was what his passion was by the end.
So why were the government bullying him and bankrupting him and threatening him with 50 years in jail?
You know, I think the government feels it's important to set an example, to make an example. Remember, all of this started around the same time that the WikiLeaks stuff was happening. And I think the word came down from on high that we're going to demonstrate we have no tolerance for people who muck about with computers, regardless of really how serious the underlying activity was. So, you know, you would think the law can tell the difference between somebody releasing the names of CIA agents or dumping the Social Security database into the public domain and somebody accessing and downloading without hacking at all. There's no violation of any technical protocol. Just accessing and downloading using a script, academic articles that were published and meant to be accessible to the public. There was no confidential information here involved at all. Any sane person can tell the difference between those two classes of cases, but the prosecutor in Boston treated them as if they were the same and insisted on felony prosecution with a requirement of jail time before he would allow this case to be settled. And that extremism, I think, you know, forced Aaron into the corner and eventually over the cliff.
And there was no monetary value to these academic articles, right? What is their case? I mean, they're treating him in the way that they go after Latvian hackers and the Russian criminal underworld or the Chinese Communist Party's hackers. How did they conflate cyber security and cyber threats with somebody who's had dedicated their life to the electronic commons?
You know, I think there's a certain attitude, at least in corners of our government, that's just intolerant of misbehaved, computer people. It's kind of simplistic and crude, but I don't understand how to explain it except by that. You know, Aaron had a history with the government. 2 years before this incident, he, along with Carl Malamud of Public Resource, had engineered a little technique which allowed them to liberate the government's PACER database. And that's a database of public records of lawsuits filed in the federal system. Now, there's no confidentiality involved here. These were public domain records, no possible claim of copyright by anybody. But the government had made them accessible behind a paywall that required people who needed information about this important resource to pay, you know, very high amounts to get access to it. So taking advantage of a loophole in the access rules that said that a public library could access them for free, he basically set up a little script to download all of the database and then made the database available freely. Originally, the FBI started prosecuting him for this, but then the judge overseeing the PACER project said this was completely legitimate and they ought to back off and celebrate what he had done rather than prosecuting him. I think that created, in the FBI at least, a sense that this is a troublemaker and we need a way to get him eventually. And so when the second case came around, they wanted to throw the book at him, even though, you know, anybody looking at this says it's outrageous that in a world where, you know, the architects of the financial crisis of 2008 dine regularly at the White House, the federal government would have some interest, some need, some requirement to label Aaron Swartz as a felon.
And the so-called aggrieved party in this, JSTOR, they declined to pursue any action against Aaron. And it seems like MIT, as you say in your article, to its great shame, was not as clear. So give us a sense of how odd it is that the government would pursue a case when the so-called aggrieved party doesn't want them to pursue it. And what was the role of MIT in being the kind of Judas in this affair?
Yeah, so there were two parts to this alleged violation. One is access of JSTOR's database improperly. And secondly, it was the, you know, physical access on MIT's campus to the resources necessary to access the JSTOR database. You know, he went on into MIT. He went into a closet, an unlocked closet at MIT, to plug his computer in so that it could do the downloading. And those steps violated, MIT said, their rules. But eventually they decided that, in fact, it didn't violate their rules. Nonetheless, they did not say to the government, stop, please don't prosecute. Even though I know from personal, firsthand knowledge, there were many people inside of MIT who were trying to get MIT to intervene to stop this prosecution because they realized the federal government was going crazy and extreme prosecution here, totally unrelated to the underlying alleged wrong. And MIT should not be a party to it. And I think, you know, I criticized MIT in my blog entry, Prosecutor as Bully. But I think, you know, we have to admit that MIT has done an important thing. On Sunday, they announced that they were going to conduct an internal review. They asked Hal Abelson, a professor at MIT, whose integrity cannot be questioned by anybody. He is the perfect judge of this, to review what MIT did and make recommendations about it. And my view is that's exactly the same thing that Carmen Ortiz, who's the federal prosecutor in Boston, should be doing. You know, she oversees that office, and in some sense she's responsible. But, you know, she's not the day-to-day, you know, frontline prosecutor. And what she should be doing is she should be conducting this same kind of review. She should be asking some independent person to look at what happened here and to affirm this is consistent with the values of the United States government for this prosecutor to basically persecute this person for these alleged crimes. Or she should say that the prosecutor went too far and give at least his family the recognition that that there was behavior here that needs to be balanced.
Again, I'm speaking with Lawrence Lessig, the director of the Edmund J. Safra Foundation Center for Ethics at Harvard University and professor of law and leadership at Harvard Law School. Previously, he was a professor of law at Stanford Law School and the University of California Law School. And additionally, Lawrence Lessig, clerk for Judge Richard Posner of the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals and Justice Antonin Scalia of the United States Supreme Court. His latest book is Republic Lost, How Money Corrupts Congress and a Plan to Stop It. Now, the idea that this U.S. attorney and obviously under pressure from the FBI went after Aaron Swartz and drove him to his death, I think unquestionably, I find it extraordinary. I mean, a little bit of this came out during the General Petraeus business where the FBI apparently decided to look into cyber harassment in the case of these two women down in Florida who may or may not have been having an affair with U.S. generals, and the girlfriend of Petraeus had apparently been harassing them. And so I looked into that because, as far as I know, it's impossible to get the FBI to get involved with any cases that, in terms of what a citizen could bring. And I happen to know somebody whose life and career has been destroyed by an abusive hacker who, because of the internet service providers are not liable like publishers and television companies are for what they put out, there is really a huge hole in the law. So I find it extraordinary to think that a friend of mine's life's been ruined because the FBI won't act against somebody who is criminally trying to extort them, saying, I'll end the pain if you pay me off. At the same time, going after somebody with such a talent and such an extraordinary record of contribution to the electronic commons, not to mention progressive politics.
Yeah. And, you know, I think this is the bigger question that we've got to think about. We have a system of prosecution in the United States where basically prosecutors are immune from all formal review by courts or by civil suits, which means basically we have to trust them. We have to trust them to get it right. And you know, I've known a lot of prosecutors, and I respect them, and I respect their work, and I think most of them are decent people trying to deal with really bad criminals. But when you know, somebody goes rogue and behaves in an extreme way, oblivious, apparently, I hope he was oblivious to the consequences his reckless behavior might entail, we need a way to review that, to check that, to evaluate, does this actually make sense? Because, you know, obviously anybody looking at the priorities of the United States government, which include, you know, basically no efforts to deal with the financial crisis, causes of the financial crisis. You know, this recent scandal at HSBC, the government basically said, well, here's a bank that's too big to prosecute. We're just not going to be prosecuting them. So, you know, these really big wrongs that really do cause big harm, or the particular harm wrongs that you're talking about, the idea that the government doesn't prosecute them either, yet takes on this case with the this kid with the vigorous prosecution that they did, just speaks to a complete lack of sense of proportionality and fairness and justice. And that is exactly the misbehavior that we need a way to police inside of our prosecutors, and I don't think we yet have an effective way to do that.
Well, Lawrence Lessig, the fact that it's so bewildering and there is such a double standard here in terms of selective prosecution, has led a lot of people on the left to speculate that Aaron Swartz was driven to his grave by the federal government because of his progressive politics. There's nothing to that, is there? I mean, tell me that I can't believe our government is that off kilter.
I wouldn't say it's progressive politics, but I wouldn't be surprised if there was a motivation to go after him as vigorously as they did, which came from his willingness to be, out there and forceful about this, in at least the sense of, what he did with the PACER database. The government's attitude is you need to ask first. Aaron's attitude was, actually, if it's in the public domain and I'm not harming your computers by getting access to it, I don't need to ask first. It's the government, and you owe it to us, and it's our taxpayer money that paid for it, so no, I don't need to ask first. And that kind of, refusal to be well-behaved, I think, in certain quarters of our government is not rewarded, to put it lightly. So, he was a troublemaker. It was their chance to get him. They got him, and we all lost.
And just sorry to do this, but a lot of our audience probably unaware of PACER. Could you just quickly describe what it was that the government found so egregious about?
Yeah, so PACER is just a database of all the filings around federal lawsuits. So you file a lawsuit, IBM versus Texas Instruments, and all of the documents around that filing get put into the PACER database. And you need this information to understand, who's filed which lawsuits, how lawsuits have turned into judicial opinions, basically that kind of information. All of it is public records. There's no secrets in it, except, of course, you're not allowed to reveal confidential information like Social Security numbers. But, in fact, one of the most ironic and striking things about the PACER exploit was that when Carl Malamud and Aaron released the PACER information, they had done a better job in stripping out the privacy in triggering information like Social Security numbers than the PACER database itself had. So they had done a better job in releasing this information publicly than the government had. Now, it won't surprise many people that private people do a better job at something than the government does. That's one of the reasons why this information is supposed to be in the public domain. But when it was released, when it was liberated, inside some sectors of the government, this was, an affront. It was an outrage, and prosecutions were launched, and, investigations were undertaken until finally somebody sensible in the judicial branch said, well, wait a minute, this is there's nothing wrong here. Put your guns back in your holsters and let's celebrate the fact that this information is now available, because that's exactly what it was supposed to be.
Well, just in closing then, Lawrence Lessig, is this really, if he's not being persecuted for his progressive politics, and I shudder to think that the government would go that far, although it has in the past had various purges against people on the left in this country, it sounds to me that this is really about a mindset within law enforcement following 9/11, particularly amongst the FBI, the notion that they don't understand really, in the real macro sense, the great contribution that people like Aaron Swartz have made to the United States and has made America the leader in terms of the internet, which of course was built here in the United States. And so much of our strength is in innovation and creativity, and that flourishes in a free environment. And they're trying to sort of, put the toothpaste back in the tube in a real sense here. Is it just that they don't get it? I mean, there's a difference between malicious Russian mafia hackers and somebody that is dedicated to the notion that American citizens have a right to know what they as taxpayers, what the government is doing in their name.
There's a difference. They should know it. If they don't know it, they should not be given the power to prosecute people for violating the law. This prosecution demonstrates they either don't know it or they don't care. That's the reason why we've got to do something in response.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Lawrence Lessig.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Lawrence Lessig, who's the director of the Edmund J. Safra Foundation for Ethics at Harvard University and a professor of law and leadership at Harvard Law School. Previously, he was a professor of law at Stanford Law School and the University of California Law School. And additionally, Lawrence Lessig, clerk for Judge Richard Posner on the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals and Justice Antonin Scalia of the United States Supreme Court. His latest book is Republic Lost, How Money Corrupts Congress and a Plan to Stop It. And he was both a close friend and a lawyer for Aaron Swartz, who is missed by all who care about freedom of the press, freedom of speech, and freedom of information. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about the French intervention in Mali. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Ambassador John Campbell, who is the Ralph Bunche Senior Fellow for Africa Policy Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. He is a former career Foreign Service officer and a former ambassador to Nigeria, a political counselor at the U.S. Embassy in Pretoria during South Africa's first non-racial elections. And his book, Nigeria, Dancing on the Brink, was published by Rowan and Littlefield, and the second edition is coming out soon. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ambassador John Campbell.
Thank you very much. It's good to be with you.
And the French appear to be, at least in terms of French public opinion, it's quite popular, their intervention in Mali. But let's go back a little bit. Is this rather, at the risk of invoking the domino theory, it seems to me that much of what's happening in the Sahel and in north of Africa are the dominoes from the collapse and removal of Gaddafi and all of the arms that trickle down south. So is this a factor in this, or are there other long-standing issues that have been inflamed by what happened in Libya?
There are other much deeper issues that are involved. The fundamental issue is the alienation of northern Mali from the regime in Bamako. This is long-standing. There have been some 20 years of promises made by the Bamako government for greater autonomy in the north and for a fairer distribution of resources. There has been, again, for a fairly long time, a low-level insurgency in the north. Now, what Libyan Arms did was it, as it were, allowed that insurgency to flare up. One of the very awkward things that I don't think we have a really good grasp of is just what the degree of public support the Islamists in the north have. You see press reports of people fleeing across the border. The question is, are they fleeing from AQIM, or are they crossing the border because there's a shortage of food? Part of the essential background to what we're talking about is an almost continuous food emergency in that region, with repeated UN appeals to the international community. So when you're talking about population movements, we have to be very careful about causation. That said, there is no question that the AQIM-linked regime in the north has been a humanitarian disaster.
And AQAM, of course, is Al-Qaeda in the Maghreb. Now, how much is this a real franchise? Because, as you know, Ambassador Campbell, everybody claims to be Al-Qaeda, and it's difficult to know whether it's become this kind of McDonald's of terrorism. So tell me about that.
I couldn't agree with you more. Just what does it mean to talk about being a franchise of an organization based in Algeria, which appears to be on the run and which has fragmented? Further, the various Islamist groups in northern Mali went after an Al-Qaeda franchise, not the other way around. So the real question is, how meaningful is it even to talk about Al-Qaeda linked? I always get very nervous when I see that phrase. For one thing, it implies that somehow or another what's going on in northern Nigeria poses a terrorist threat, which eventually could even affect the United States. Don't think so.
So at this point, Ambassador Campbell, what we're looking at are kind of Mad Max pictures of these desert convoys of SUVs with machine guns mounted on them. And
that's right.
And if the French have Mirage jets and their Air Force in there, it would seem to me that this would be a pretty one-sided fight.
Well, I think it will be, at least in conventional terms. And it's why I would expect the early liberation of Timbuktu, Gao, and one or two other cities. I would also suggest that fundamentally that's largely irrelevant. The Islamic militants will simply fall back into the desert, which is where they have been before. And the Polisario have shown us that you can carry on an insurgency based in a desert for a very long time.
And this is the guerrilla group that's been at a long guerrilla war against the Moroccan government.
That's right.
For what, decades now, right?
Decades now. And they're still there.
Right. Again,
of course, Morocco is a lot stronger a state than any of the others that we're talking about here.
And what's their ideological underpinning?
Which one?
Polisario. And I'm trying to get a sense of how much this is ideology and how much this is gangsterism,
Polisario,
opportunism, whatever.
Right.
You know.
What Polisario wants is that they want an independent state of Western Sahara. At least in theory, what the groups in northern Mali want is the establishment of an Islamic state conducted according to to a very, very rigid interpretation of Sharia law.
So what attends that, of course, are human rights abuses, and there's a possibility of, isn't there a French soldier that's been captured or killed?
Well, there's been at least one French soldier killed.
Right. But how much of these roaming bands of so-called Al-Qaeda in the Maghreb, you know, established any kind of government in order to know exactly what their agenda would be?
They have established in certain places a regime of negatives. I'm thinking of things like the destruction of the tombs of saints in Timbuktu, which were a World Heritage Site. The dramatic use of Sharia punishments, I think at least in part, to terrorize the local population. But I don't think we can talk about a kind of coalition in any sort of meaningful sense. It's rather a bunch of warlords who talk about, yes, Sharia, but also keeping the smuggling lines open and the revenue flowing in.
Again, I'm speaking with Ambassador John Campbell, who is the Ralph Bunche Senior Fellow for Africa Policy Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. He is a former career Foreign Service officer and a former ambassador to Nigeria and political counselor to the U.S. Embassy in Pretoria during South Africa's first non-racial elections. His book, Nigeria Dancing on the Brink, was published in 2010, and its second edition is coming out soon. And we're talking about Mali and the extent to which the French have intervened to prop up a extremely, it would seem, a corrupt and incompetent regime there, particularly militarily speaking, Ryan.
Well, it would indeed seem that way. I mean, that, it seems to me, is a fundamental part of the problem. If there was a credible and responsible government in Bamako, and there's not, and no immediate prospect of one, but if there was one, I think the internal fissures within the militants in the north would widen.
So the U.S. doesn't have any fingerprints on this, right?
No.
That would not help if already the Al-Qaeda and the Maghreb are talking about the Crusaders invading and this being a war on behalf of Islam against the Crusaders. I imagine the French are not much looked upon much more favorably than the U.S., but what's your sense then of where the U.S. is in the sense of it's not having any direct fingerprints, but what is U.S. policy and what do you understand is being advocated behind the scenes?
Well, this is going to be a dilemma. What the U.S. Has advocated is that Mali be approached as a regional issue, making use of the Economic Community of West African States, or ECOWAS. And ECOWAS has been in the process of putting together an armed force which would require subsequent training that could be deployed in northern Mali. Now, putting together that kind of force is not easy. Poor West African states don't have a whole lot of spare troops. Nigeria, for example, a few days ago, announced that instead of providing 600 troops, it could only provide 450, and that it could not meet the bills for the ECOWAS expedition, which it has done in previous cases. Nigeria is badly stretched by Boko Haram in the north. To a greater or lesser extent, most of these states have internal issues. So you don't just simply wave a magic wand and put together an ECOWAS force, train it, and send it off in a month's time. And in fact, it's the length of time required that may have been part of the French motivation to move.
So where does this U.S. Trans-Sahara Counterterrorism Partnership, the TSCPT, where does it stand? Because hasn't the U.S. been involved in trying to organize some kind of force in this part of the world and doesn't look like it's working out too well?
I would say it's been a disaster. The centerpiece for the initiative was U.S. in-depth training of indigenous African forces. And that has proceeded in some places. Unfortunately, in Mali, some of those so trained bolted for the insurgents. In Bamako, the person that mounted the coup against the civilian government, Sanubu, had been trained by the U.S. forces. So I would have thought that this would cause considerable thought on the part of the architects of that initiative.
So, and these were the U.S. trained some Tuaregs, right, who they thought they'd turned.
That's exactly what it was.
And in fact, they turned against the U.S.
They did.
Mm-hmm. And so we're left with what? The French bailing out the remnants of this corrupt government.
That's right.
And the U.S. is sort of on the sidelines, what, hoping for the best?
Well, I would suspect, don't know this, because in fact, I am retired from the State Department. I retired from the State Department when I came to the Council. So I'm not privy to the inner workings of U.S. policy on this, but I would suspect that what the U.S. is doing is diplomatically trying to reach some kind of accommodation among the various elements in Bamako to produce a credible government. There's a real problem here, though, And that problem is that there are indeed draconian restrictions applied by Congress in a situation where a coup overthrows a legitimately elected government. Well, that's what happened here. Now, that government may have been wildly unpopular at the time it was overthrown, but still, it was a legitimately elected government.
So if Congress is hamstrung by that stricture, what about the administration itself? I mean,
well, the administration particularly is hamstrung by it because it's the law of the land.
Right, but in terms of their point people, who, I mean, we've seen a bruising situation with Susan Rice is now because of the United Nations, but she was the Africa expert. Who is, in whose lap has this landed?
Well, according to an organizational chart, it would be Johnny Carson, who is the Assistant Secretary for African Affairs.
And what's your understanding of... my understanding is that as soon as you start talking about Al-Qaeda, you get a lot of attention in Washington, D.C.
Well, you do, and you particularly get it from the Department of Defense.
So what's happening with DOD? Are they chafing at the bit to get in here, or are they just letting the French take the lead?
It's more complicated than that. Whenever you talk about Al-Qaeda linked, red flags go up all over the place. In my view, particularly in parts of the Department of Defense, particularly among certain conservative members of Congress.
And how much influence do they have in with the rest of the government there in Washington? And I mean, is it?
Well, we saw what happened to Susan Rice, didn't we?
I see. So then, I mean, it's almost like the ghost of Jesse Helms is coming back. Tell me, though, is it? What are the indications, then, that the conservatives are beating the drum for the U.S. to get involved? I mean...
That I have not seen yet.
Right.
And I tend to doubt that that's going to happen in any overt sense. I cannot imagine any American political support for getting involved in Mali. I mean, most people don't have the vaguest notion where it is. And in the aftermath of Iraq and Afghanistan, the last thing most Americans want is sending off American troops to someplace they never heard of before. Now, they're perfectly happy to do it if it's for purposes of humanitarian relief. But that's not exactly what we're talking about here.
So your sense then is that even though there may be some conservative voices in the U.S. military may be concerned about Al-Qaeda in the Maghreb, on the other side, on the administration side, they're a little gun-shy, are they? That was the suggestion, I take it, from what happened to Susan Rice, that you know, we don't need any boots on the ground. And even though we had, you know, the Libyan war, if you can call it that, was an exemplar of not having boots on the ground, it nevertheless came back to haunt the administration.
It did indeed. To say gun-shy is too strong. It's too strong because I think everybody recognizes that there would be no political constituency for American intervention in Mali. Now, I suppose that could change. That could change if there were a whole series of highly publicized, ghastly human rights abuses, you know, splashed all over television. But right now, I don't see any sign of that.
Well, that may have a lot to do with the fact that what a harsh and inaccessible place it is, and if the press were brave enough or foolish enough to get in there, they may be held hostage like the French.
Indeed, that is a very realistic concern.
So just in closing then, Ambassador John Campbell, what's your sense of where this is heading then? I take it you feel that militarily it'll change fairly quickly in the favor of the French, but that won't be the end of it.
That's right. That what will happen militarily and in a fairly short term is that the historic cities of Mali, like Timbuktu or Gao, they will be retaken. But I would anticipate that Ansar Dine and the other radical Islamists will melt into the desert and will, at very best, continue a kind of low-level insurgency for a very long time. Now, if you are looking for some kind of real solution to the problem, that requires the establishment of a credible government in Bamako, which makes promises to the North, which it then proceeds to keep. That hasn't happened yet.
Well, Ambassador John Campbell, I thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Ambassador John Campbell, who is the Ralph Bunche Senior Fellow for Africa Policy Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. He is a former career Foreign Service officer and a former ambassador to Nigeria and political counselor to the U.S. Embassy in Pretoria during South Africa's first non-racial elections. His book, Nigeria Dancing on the Brink, was published in 2010, and the second edition is coming out soon. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about how the wages for working Americans are going down while profits are going up. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. Joining us now is Lawrence Michel, an economist, author, and analyst. He is the president of the Economic Policy Institute and is the principal author of the research volume published every 2 years that's widely considered the authoritative text on the American workforce, The State of Working America. His latest report is titled, We're Not Broke, Nor Will We Be. Welcome to Background Briefing, Lawrence Michel.
Thanks for having me again.
And Lawrence, in Sunday's New York Times opinion section, there's an article about the economy called Our Economic Pickle. And it says, take for example Caterpillar, long a symbol of American industry. While it reported record profits last year, it insisted on a 6-year wage freeze for many of its blue-collar workers. Wages have fallen to a record low as a share of America's gross domestic product. But last year's wages fell to a record low of 43.5% since 2001, when the wage share was 49%. So there you have it. I mean, obviously capital is the beneficiary of increased productivity, but American capitalists are not sharing their bounty with their workers.
Well, that article, which draws heavily on our research, really does pinpoint one of the key dynamics of the last 30 years, and one that has been really salient in the last 10 years, and that is that the wages of most workers have not risen in 10 years, including college graduates as well as high school graduates, even though productivity, the expansion of the pie, has been growing. So that means that there's been a lot of output that has been generated, but most of it has not gone to the vast middle class. The article also points out something interesting that, we're spending all our time dealing with the deficit issues and debt. And should we even resolve all that, we're not really even addressing this fundamental issue, which is how are we going to get shared prosperity for most people, something that has not been the case for 30 years and is definitely not the case now, as incomes are going nowhere for most everybody.
So given that the majority of Americans work for a living and they're not the 1%, maybe they're the 47% that Mitt Romney talked about, but they're certainly not the 1%, why is it then that the 99% cannot get economic justice and the 1% continue to reap the main rewards of the American economy?
Well, the first thing to note is it's not by accident. I mean, the economy isn't working well for most people because that's the way it has been designed to work over the last 30 years. So there's been a number of policies that have been put in place that really put working people at a disadvantage when it comes to getting higher wages. And this has been happening since mid-Jimmy Carter. And it's happened under both Democrats and Republicans, I'm afraid to say. So, you know, we had deregulation, which undercut workers' ability to earn a decent living in airlines and transportation. We've seen an erosion of the minimum wage. We've seen a weakening of unions and a failure to update the laws regarding people's ability to secure collective bargaining where they want to do it. We've seen globalization where we are putting workers at all different wage levels in competition with those from abroad, whether it be low-wage workers in China or more skilled technical workers from India or workers in Mexico, et cetera. This all has the effect of undercutting wages for the vast majority. And now it's even the case that 70% of college graduates earn less now than 10 years ago. So this is not an economy that's really working for hardly anybody, except for those who reap returns to financial assets. So that story about Caterpillar earning, you know, huge profits, but not having to, not willing to, nor having to raise wages for its workers is really emblematic of what's happening for the economy as a whole.
Again, I'm speaking with Dr. Lawrence Michel, who is an economist, author, and analyst. He's the president of the Economic Policy Institute and the principal author of a research volume published every 2 years that is widely considered the authoritative text on the American workforce, The State of Working America. His latest report is titled, We're Not Broke, Nor Will We Be. So is that to say then, Lawrence Michel, that globalism and the new global economy is being used as an excuse by America's corporate elite, the 1%, to basically take all the money themselves? I mean, in effect, you could make the case that globalism has been good for Wall Street and maybe for Chinese and Sri Lankan peasants, but has not been good for working America.
Well, I think globalization could have been done in ways that would have been better for working people here as well as for working people abroad. But when economists tell you that trade is good for our nation, globalization makes us better off, what they fail to pinpoint is that economic theory also says that globalization is going to necessarily increase to greater inequality, so that a lot of people are going to be losers in terms of worse job security, worse wages from globalization, and that globalization makes us all better off only if there's a redistribution from the winners to the losers. And they never seem to want to talk about that redistribution from the winners to the losers to make us better off. As it is, I think the bottom three-fourths of our workforce and households are clear losers from globalization. They potentially could be winners, but we don't do things to make sure that everybody has enough, the health care, a pension, decent wages, et cetera. We could do that. They do that in some other countries, but we don't.
So what's it going to take then? I mean, we have a new Secretary of the Treasury that's been nominated, who's apparently an expert on the budget. He's a Beltway insider. My understanding from having spoken recently with Michael Greenberger, who used to be with the Commodities Futures Trading Commission in charge of markets at the CTFC, and he knows Wall Street, and he was basically saying that the new Secretary of Treasury is not somebody that understands finance and understands what's happening on Wall Street, and we still have systemic risk in spite of 2008 and the massive meltdown and Dodd-Frank and efforts to curtail the power of the banks. The big banks are more powerful than ever, and that there really is no early warning system in place, and there's still this systemic risk. So if there's another financial meltdown, the one that's, you know, on top of the one that's already crippling us now, we simply don't have the money to bail them out. We don't have the $12 trillion that we used last time to dig our way out of the hole. So do you see this disconnect? We're talking about how American workers aren't getting paid commensurate with the rest of the world and certainly with their employers, and that if they were, that would improve the economy. And at the same time, we have Wall Street in their sort of more than ever laissez-faire recklessness.
Well, I think these are some good points. So, first of all, the Secretary of Treasury is going to do what the president wants. And so I think there's always some sense that somehow the people around Obama are the problem rather than what the president himself believes. I'm not sure why anyone would argue that. But it's the economic problems fall into three or four categories. One, you're right, there's still issues regarding financialization and Wall Street. Related to that are the still ongoing problems in the housing sector. Two, we have major budget issues, and so it's really important that someone be there who's going to negotiate and is going to preserve our social insurance programs rather than undercut them. I'm very fearful about the administration and their commitment to maintaining the integrity of Medicare and Social Security. And third, there's the issue we started off with, which is really, you know, for most people, the salient issue is how are we going to get more jobs and how are we going to get wages to be rising for most people? And so how are we going to have an economic policy that puts that front and basically what we focus on, and that all economic policy needs to be looked at through the lens of, what is this going to do to get more jobs and higher wages for the vast majority?
And why isn't somebody out there making the point that for all of this talk from the deficit hawks and the threat to shut down the government because of having to raise the debt ceiling, that, first of all, the Tea Party people who did it last time, all they succeeded in doing was increasing the deficit because they added to the cost of debt because we got downgraded as a result of their irresponsible behavior. So you've got the Republicans being the wrecking crew, but you don't have a strong argument from the Democrats saying, look, what we really need to get to pay off our debt and to get back on our feet is for everybody in America to be working and getting a decent wage, and that money then is able to, in the form of increased tax revenues, pay off the debt and bring us back into balance. And, you know, it's just incredibly straightforward economics 101. Why isn't somebody making this a case for an alternative to the Pete Peterson mantra of the sky is falling because of the deficits?
Well, I think that there are people making those arguments, but they don't have the political power. So I think we there's those who favor those kinds of policies. I think we have to say two things. One is there's sort of a corruption of money in politics that distorts the policy positions of both parties, in my view. And two, the forces that represent the vast majority, civil rights organizations, community groups, the labor movement, are far weaker than they need to be. And so we have a political imbalance that generates a distortion in what we focus on as the key economic issues. So, I say this so that people don't, it's not, you know, be critical of any particular administration or politician. They respond to the political array of forces. So if we don't think they are focused in the right way, then we have to ask, what can happen to build the political organization's strength that are going to make them focus on what the vast majority need?
So, in other words, the public has got to signal very loud and clear what they want. Now,
Don't warn, organize. don't complain, organize.
Right. Well, what about informing the public? I mean, you know, there's so much of the public that seems to have bought the Pete Peterson. I mean, the idea that this Wall Street billionaire is telling everybody that you, working Americans and middle-class Americans, have to tighten your belt, but us titans on Wall Street just free us up and everything will be hunky-dory. I mean, why are people, do you think, drinking that Kool-Aid?
Well, one is that, you know, I think Sensible Policy lost a huge communications battle over the stimulus. And the most, in other words, that the idea that government spending or government policy to lower unemployment was ineffective. In fact, it wasn't ineffective. We were just in a really, really deep hole. And we lost that battle, and most people believe that government budgets are like household budgets, and in tough times we have to constrain ourselves, when in fact government budgets need to be looser when household budgets are in fact tighter. So, you know, and there's been an intellectual defeat of Keynesianism in the academy, which has another whole story behind it. So there's a lot of stuff going on, and frankly, the political forces that would make that argument are too weak, the argument that you would like to see made. So I think, you know, the information is out there. It doesn't get a megaphone in the, you know, the punditry. It's acknowledged sometimes, and even when we have a debate like the fiscal cliff, so let's just recall, fiscal cliff was about a situation where at the beginning of the year we were about to have large tax increases and huge spending cuts, both of which take money out of the economy, shrink demand. And we were afraid of doing that and doing massive deficit reduction. That the whole point was massive deficit reduction was going to throw us into a recession. Now, how many people in the United States, when they heard the coverage of the fiscal cliff, got the message that the problem was massive deficit reduction about to happen? No one got that, because that's not the way it was covered. They all thought there was some debt explosion, exactly the opposite. So, I mean, there's a lot of work to be done, and the kind of work that you do is very important. So we need more people to tune into your show.
Well, on that note, Lawrence Michel, I thank you so much for joining us.
Okay, take care. Bye-bye.
You too. Again, I've been speaking with Lawrence Michel, who's an economist, author, and analyst. He's the president of the Economic Policy Institute and the principal author of a research volume published every 2 years that is widely considered the authoritative text on the American workforce, The State of Working America. His latest report is titled, We're Not Broke, Nor Will We Be. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me. And the conversation continues at facebook.com/ianmastersmedia. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Time.